partisan gridlock has been the name of the game in Washington for the past 4 years. The 2010 midterms resulted in a power split between Republicans and Democrats in the House and Senate, respectively. And since then, any major reform has been elusive.
MSNBC's Chris Matthews says that's not what divided government has always looked like. In his latest book, Tip and the Gipper, When Politics Worked, he harkens back to a time when President Ronald Reagan and Democratic House Speaker Tip O'Neill worked closely together, even as ideological opponents, to forge compromises.
Matthews, who worked as a top aide to O'Neill, says we need to rebuild the culture of deal-making in Washington in the run-up to a round of elections that are projected to give Republicans the majority in both chambers of Congress. Chris Matthews joins us now. Chris, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, Nate Silver's popular polling website, 538, shows Republicans with a 65% chance of taking the Senate. And it takes guts to contradict Nate Silver, but do you agree with this? Do you see it as likely that Republicans will take the Senate in the midterms?
Well, you know, I've never quite grasped the notion of using percentages. I mean, you have to prediction is a prediction. If you go to a horse race, you bet on a horse, and you say that a horse is going to win. There's so much cloudiness among these forecasters. They have 58, 65, 75, 93. These numbers, I'm not sure what they mean. I guess it's saying that if it's over 50%, it's going to happen, or they predict it's going to happen. So I guess I'll just take it as a binary prediction. But I think it's a sound one that I don't see any wind blowing in the president's direction or the Democrats' direction, where I see modest winds blowing against them. For example, the whole question of how we're dealing with Ebola can't be satisfactory to most voters. Or the sort of concern in the backdrop of in the background of ISIS, I don't see a positive reason to vote yes. And I think most elections come down to a yes or no, a binary choice. You like the way things are going, or you don't like the way things are going, and you vote accordingly.
The Wall Street Journal published an article earlier this month saying that data shows that some of the most productive times for the federal government have been when power is split between the president and Congress, red in one, blue in the other. Does that ring true based on your experience in politics?
Well, my book is, the book Tip and the Gipper is all about that. And you had a Democratic Speaker of the House, my boss, Tip O'Neill, and a conservative Republican president. And they were able to get the corporate tax, actually the individual rates down to 28%. By plugging loopholes. They were able to save the Social Security system all these years since 1983 by an adjustment in the COLA, a timing of the COLA, and, of course, changing the tax basis for financing the system. They were able to do a lot in terms of foreign policy, Northern Ireland, and, of course, ending the Cold War. A lot of it was done behind the scenes, but a lot of these deals were right out front. They cut deals. And they didn't agree on philosophy, but they were able to find compromise.
Now, why was that? Was that because of the strength of these two personalities or idiosyncrasies that were unique to Ronald Reagan and Tip O'Neill? Or are there bigger takeaways that could be applied right now, for instance?
Well, I think you nailed it the first time. I think Tip was a big liberal from Massachusetts. He'd always been a big spender and proud of it. And and when he spoke, the liberals in the party were with him implicitly. When he spoke the language and the values and the positions of liberalism. The same with Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan was the Mr. Conservative. So when he spoke for a whole political movement, the new modern conservative movement. So they could lead that way ideologically. That was a great strength. But I think there was another sense that they had. They were both older men in their 70s. And to them, this was the final inning of the game. They had to get it done. And I get the sense on every issue today, there's the kick the can down the road mentality. Oh, we'll do it after the election, or we'll do it after we come back with the next Congress, or we'll do it with the next presidency. They flip every issue onto the next playing field. Oh, we'll get to that. I think the two things are leadership, personal leadership, and a sense of urgency. They're both missing.
MSNBC is a network that's often seen as the liberal counterpart to Fox News. It's a kind of media polarization that can take heat for contributing to politically polarized, gridlocked politics that are going on in our country. Do you feel any responsibility for that partisan politics that we're living through?
Because I've said to you in the last 5 minutes is what I've been saying on the air pretty relentlessly. In fact, I sometimes think I'm saying it too often when I push for compromise. And I think that in the days of Tip O'Neill and Ronald Reagan, they were both polarized figures. It's not that you polarize in your philosophy. It's not that you have a very different view than the other person. It's can you compromise? And it isn't a battle among moderates and centrists. The real decisions in life tend to be made by people at the extremes when they come together. That's when you have true peace treaties. And that's the norm. And I think that it's not about not having true belief or principles. It's about taking those principles to the table and getting the best deal you can. Recognize that you have a greater goal, which is to keep the republic moving forward. And I think those are very consistent value systems, principle and pragmatism.
We're talking to MSNBC Hardball host Chris Matthews in the run-up to Tuesday's midterm elections. In his latest book called Tip and the Gipper, he harkens back to Reagan-era compromises between Republicans and Democrats.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're back with MSNBC Hardball host Chris Matthews. We're talking about solving political gridlock as we look to Tuesday's midterm elections. Chris, we often blame the politicians for gridlock, but do you think that's fair, or is there more to the story? Have other things changed, like the electorate, the courts, or the media?
Well, we do continue. If you want to blame the public, I think you're going down the wrong route, because the public has almost always divided its allegiance pretty much down the middle. This country hasn't rocked really far to the right or far to the left. I mean, maybe the first New Deal, maybe the year or so after Kennedy's assassination, the country went to the left. In the first year of Ronald Reagan, it went to the right. We're very much like the French voter. We're very much bourgeois and pragmatic and somewhere down the center, if you add it all up. But I hold the politicians accountable. I think their number one goal is reelection. And the way to get reelected today is to play to the polls, to the left or the right. Feed the interest groups with what they want to hear. Tell them you're never going to give up. You're always going to fight. And like if you're on the right, the Tea Party, you say you're against any taxes, any government, any regulation. You just say no, no, no to everything that the president wants to do. You undermine Obamacare. It's totally viciously negative. If you're on the liberal side of things, you just vote for every spending bill. You vote for all the interest groups, all the pressure groups. You say all the right things, and you get reelected. You get 100% ADA rating, and you've never had to negotiate or really be a politician. A politician is someone who gets in a room and negotiates their way to a solution. And I don't think there are many true politicians left. Bill Clinton was one. I mean, he had welfare reform and reducing the debt and deficit. He ran 3 or 4 years of surpluses. He dealt with the issues before him, and trade reform and welfare reform. He found a way to get along with Newt Gingrich, and I don't see that today with the president. I don't see him ever getting a deal with Boehner or Mitch McConnell ever, and I'm afraid of the next 2 years for that reason.
No,
maybe it's just the lack of talent. You know, we all have our different talents. Some people can give wonderful speeches like the president. And some people may be tongue-tied, but when they get in the back room, they have an instinct for the other person's position, and they know where they can move them. They know what they really want and what they're willing to give up, and they use that as a basis of trade.
Now, you mentioned the name Clinton, and I know that you're a supporter of Hillary Clinton in 2016. Democrats who support her feel that she could get things done, they say, where President Obama hasn't really been able to move the needle very much, some say. And analysts have criticized Hillary for accomplishing only what they say is token legislation in the Senate, and also for outspoken support of the Iraq War. And that's essentially the gist of the cover story in Harper's this month. So specifically, I'm curious, where do you think Hillary Clinton would have done right where President Obama may have gone wrong?
Well, I don't know. It's very hard to intercede in history and say, let me think through point by point. She tried on health care and failed because Dingell was against her, and I think Moynihan was against her, and the big committee chairs weren't on her side. She didn't have great relations with those people at all. In fact, they were hostile to her, I think. Certainly Moynihan was. And they just didn't see it the way, they didn't see their way to it. I don't think she was very successful there in negotiating. However, her diplomatic experience for 6 years was purely in that area. I think she has openly made friendships. If you can make it this simple, I think her friendship with people like John McCain are real. I think she, in the back room with you, with the brief times I've been with her in the back room or occasions, I find her to be incredibly gracious and likable, if that's the right word for somebody in that position. And I think that people will enjoy working with her. They'll just enjoy being there with her in the back room if she's president, trying to figure the thing out. I think she also although she's a bit, elite in her academic background, it doesn't hold her back from liking politicians. Whereas I get the sense that Obama doesn't like politicians. I think he has disdain for them. Look at when he meets with them, he says, let's go meet at the Jefferson Hotel, and I'll have a dozen of you guys over. Instead of having them over to have dinner or play cards with them, or spend any really quality time with them in a bonding way, he has these sort of formal structures to meet with people. I don't think Hillary will be that bad. I have to believe that her life in politics since the time she was practically in her early 20s has accustomed her to the political life that she's obviously thrived in and wants to continue in. So I think Obama just is a bit of a professor, and he doesn't really enjoy that sort of sitting up having a few drinks on into the night, talking about everything, and somewhere in that long conversation and friendship, finding opportunities for a deal. And I think it's the only place that you can find that deal, is somewhere when your hearts are open and your minds are open, and you're actually wanting to make this work, that you can actually get there. I think Hillary wants to be a success if she's president. I don't think the honor of the office is what she's after. I think she would want to be a great president and get things done and put, like her husband did, and get things done. And I think when Bill Clinton goes back and says, what did he do? Have family home leave, NAFTA, reducing the debt down to a surplus for 3 or 4 years there. I think you end up wanting those objective successes.
Well, we got to talk some about Wisconsin politics. And we are in the final week of what's been called the tightest gubernatorial race in Wisconsin. What do you make of our current race for governor here in the state?
Well, I've been surprised. I know that Walker beat the recall, and I was impressed with that. I was impressed with his sturdiness. And then all these questions about campaign financing, and now Mary Burke running this very strong campaign. You know, I like to be able to predict elections, and that's one I can't predict. I think Mary Burke can beat him. I'll just say that, but that's not very deep a thought, given the polling. I think that a lot of the governors are in trouble now. I think Corbett of my home state is in big trouble. I think that LePage up in Maine is going to lose. I think Rick Scott could lose. This is a very difficult time to be a successful governor, and the only one I can think of who's been immensely successful is Jerry Brown, who's now about to get elected to his fourth term as governor. I'm hiding from your question because I don't have the slightest answer. Who's going to win your race next Tuesday?
Well, there's another narrative that's kind of growing out of this gubernatorial race in the past couple of days, and that is whether or not there is any bad blood between Governor Walker and Chris Christie, based on Chris Christie's position with the Republican Governors Association, and whether he's been throwing enough support Governor Walker's way. It's been sort of seesawing a little bit. Do you see that as being a narrative that's going to have any effect in the race?
No, I just Christie likes a good fight, and that's all I know. I don't know anything about the particular intramurals here, but I know that Christie he sort of conforms to what Churchill once said about John Foster Dulles. He's a bull that carries his china shop around with him, and I think he likes to fight. I think he's picking a fight with the president right now over Ebola, treatment of Ebola and quarantining people. And I think it's this tough guy from New Jersey image that he's sporting right now. None of your business, Gail, that kind of thing with people, even treating women that way. And I think he thinks that actual boorishness is going to be attractive to voters who are tired of political polish. But I don't think so. I'm not sure it will travel very well westward. I think that may be of limited appeal beyond, say, Philadelphia.
Now, in a recent column, conservative David Brooks, he wrote, the 2014 campaign has been the most boring and uncreative campaign I can remember. A lot of people don't vote in midterms. Do the midterms matter?
Well, they do in a sense that here's something to keep an eye on that I think your listeners may not be thinking about, but I think about it, the subpoena power. Now, when Nixon lost the House in 72 after being reelected with 60-some percent, he realized he'd lost the subpoena power in the House. In other words, the Democratic majority in the House would have that weapon to wield against him. And, of course, they did, as did the Senate Democrats. They wielded it against him. The Watergate hearings were a tremendous success and did tremendous damage to Nixon. They exposed the taping system, for example. And then, of course, the House impeachment effort on the Judiciary Committee led by Peter Rodino was enormously respected. In fact, Congress probably had a higher respect level then than any time in modern history because of the way they handled impeachment. Under Reagan, the Democrats controlled the Congress, and it was Dan Inouye, of course, and then the Republicans had Henry Hyde, but it was basically on the other side, but basically they were able to use it. Now, if the Senate, and the same thing happened with Clinton's impeachment, if the Senate goes Republican next Tuesday, then John McCain, who's ranking member on the permanent investigating subcommittee of the Senate, and that's the permanent committee. It's the only body in Congress, the only panel that has unilateral partisan control of the subpoena power. All John McCain would have to do is issue a subpoena by himself. He doesn't need the ranking member to help him on the other side. He would have the power that Joe McCarthy had back in the day that when he ran that committee. Now, he wouldn't use it the same way, of course, but he would have enormous power and respect if he decided to invest in this administration on Benghazi, on the IRS, or any of those troubling areas. And so he will have that power, John McCain. Now, I don't know how he'll use it, but that's a thing to think about, that he would be up against the president again in a whole new arena. And I'm watching that. That's one thing I pay attention to. The subpoena power goes to the majority. If the Republicans get the majority, they get that power. And as I said, with the Permanent Investigating Subcommittee, you don't ever need the Democrats to agree to a subpoena. You just go ahead and do it.
Chris, thanks a lot for joining us.
Hey, thank you. It's great being on.
That was MSNBC Hardball host Chris Matthews. His latest book is Tip and the Gipper, When Politics Worked.